Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause, who examines Attorney General Barr's mishandling of the Mueller report's release, and debate on whether or not House Democrats should launch impeachment proceedings against President Trump. Colin Reese, senior campaigner with Oil Change International, who talks about gathering opposition to President Trump's recent executive orders to speed up approval of fossil fuel pipeline and infrastructure projects. And Drew Hudson, a member of the group Beyond Extreme Energy, who talks about BXE's campaign opposing the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's current role as a rubber stamp for the fossil fuel industry. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A week after a military coup toppled Sudan's dictator Omar al-Bashir, activists who had flooded the capital city of Khartoum for months remained in the streets calling for civilian rule, a demand endorsed by the African Union. Protests started in December after Bashir imposed austerity measures and devalued the currency. Opposition activists led by women and students soon called for Bashir to resign. The military council that took over following Bashir's ouster said it would lead a 2-year transition that could end sooner under the right political conditions. The coup leaders are supported by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who pledged to provide economic aid. The Sudanese Professionals Association, a group that spearheaded the protests, renewed its calls for a civilian-led political transition and called on citizens to continue their sit-in at the army headquarters. The opposition umbrella group known as the Forces for Freedom and Change includes the Sudan Call, the leftist consensus forces, and representatives of civil society. However, after 30 years of division and infighting, alliances and rivalries within the traditional political parties make it harder to organize a truly united front against the military council. Back in 2012, then Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker appeared on Meet the Press and defended Mitt Romney from criticisms over the Republican presidential candidate's career at Bain Capital, urging President Obama and other Democrats to stop attacking private equity. Despite recent moves to try to distance himself from Wall Street interests, including swearing off corporate PAC money, pledging support for Medicare for All, and running for president this year as an unabashed progressive, questions remain about Booker's relationship with corporate America. In 2018, Booker received major campaign contributions from individuals working in major Wall Street firms such as Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Prudential Financial, in addition to lobbying firms associated with Big Pharma and pro-Israel PACs. How much influence will these donors have on Booker's positions on the issues? Although he's consistently voted against Wall Street deregulation, the New Jersey senator has sided with Israel-backed legislation against boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, and has a mixed record on health care. In January 2017, Booker voted with the Senate GOP majority against an amendment urging the federal government to allow Americans to buy cheaper prescription drugs from Canada. The stench coming from the landfill in West Jefferson, Alabama, northwest of Birmingham, was so bad that you couldn't walk outside without suffering headaches and nausea and being swarmed by insects attracted to the source of the smell, which was tens of thousands of tons of human waste. The landfill, called Big Sky Environmental, sits on the fringes of West Jefferson and is permitted to accept waste from 48 U.S. states. It used a nearby rail spur to import sewage from New York and New Jersey. From the train cars, the waste was transported by truck, which drove through city streets, sometimes spilling dark liquid onto the street on their way to the landfill. Alabama has gained a reputation as America's dumping ground, with toxic waste from across the country typically heaped near poor rural communities, many with large African-American populations. 2 years ago, residents living near the Stone's Throw landfill in Montgomery County claimed the toxic dump there was the cause of chronic illnesses like asthma and cancer, and thus violated the Federal Civil Rights Act. In December, however, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency ruled there was insufficient evidence for the complaint. Now, according to the Guardian newspaper, more than 40 black residents are suing the landfill operator, Advanced Disposal Services, and two water utility companies for allowing heavy metals, E. coli, and hazardous chemicals to leach into the local water supply, which they claim caused their abdominal cancers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
In the days since Attorney General William Barr released a redacted version of the long-awaited Mueller report, the 448-page document reveals major contradictions between what Mr. Barr told the nation when he released his earlier four-page summary and during a press conference, and what the report actually says. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer charged that Barr deliberately distorted significant portions of Special Counsel Mueller's report in an effort to give the document a positive spin on the president's behalf. The areas where Mr. Barr misled the nation included sanitizing Robert Mueller's conclusion that the Trump campaign had indeed been complicit with Russian interference in the 2016 election, but that those activities fell short of what he defined as coordination. Mueller also directly contradicts Barr's summary to state that he declined to prosecute Trump for obstruction of justice based solely on a Justice Department legal opinion, saying that the Justice Department can't indict a sitting president, and explicitly asserts that Congress should be the body to now determine whether or not President Trump should be held accountable for obstructing justice. Your reporter spoke with Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause, who examines Attorney General Barr's mishandling of the Mueller report's release, the Democratic Party-controlled House constitutional duty to pursue accountability for presidential misconduct, and whether or not to launch impeachment proceedings against Mr. Trump.
I believe that the Attorney General has diminished the credibility of the Department of Justice, and it is not completely clear to me whether he will be cooperating by providing the unredacted version of the Mueller report, as well as the underlying evidence to Congress and the committees that need to do further investigation. His handling of this was, in my mind, appalling. First, sending a memo describing, and I think, you know, really kind of whitewashing what this report did, and said basically that it was an exoneration of Trump. And in his press conference that he held the morning before the redacted report was sent over to Congress and before reporters had a chance to even read it or the American public, he announced that this was an exoneration of Trump, that Trump fully cooperated with the investigation, which is a complete joke, really had a couple of chances to do PR and messaging that helped Donald Trump brag in both instances, in the initial letter that he sent and this press conference, that it was a complete exoneration, no collusion, no obstruction, and continuing to lie about both the investigation, which was a real and concrete investigation, and also about the outcome of it.
Karen, one of the big debates right now within the Democratic Party, which controls the House of Representatives, is where do they go now? Do they move towards impeachment hearings? Do they further investigate? Do they make calculations that impeachment probably won't pass muster in the Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans, so bypass impeachment? There's a lot roiling within the Democratic Party right now. What's your view of what should take place at this moment?
Without a doubt, an impeachment process is a political process. The power to do this is mandated in the Constitution that the House of Representatives has the ability to conduct an investigation to hold the president accountable, because no one is above the law. And so they could begin investigations, impeachment investigations, to look at the issues that have come up in this report, dig deeper to see the underlying evidence. And also there are, and I've seen 10 or 14 other investigations happening. So there is a lot more to come. One of the challenges I think we face and others face that want to take a look at how we bring this administration to justice is that so much of the investigation has happened behind closed doors and the American people haven't seen much of it. And it can be really compelling when you hear someone testify. Think about when Michael Cohen testified about his interactions with Trump and the hush money payments and everything else. That is compelling to hear it from other people. And so I think one of the things that has to happen, and whether they're impeachment hearings or just House oversight, judiciary, and intelligence hearings, they need to be conducting investigations to get more information about what Mueller discovered, have Barr testify to hear about his perspective and why he came out with what he did, why when they were presenting this, Mueller wasn't standing there. And I think it's very important to hear Mueller's perspective of what he's found so that we can get to the bottom of this. And I actually think as they continue to look at more information, including the ongoing investigations, they can make the decision about whether they pursue impeachment. Some have talked about censure. But I think the most important thing is that we do not let this abuse of power and obstruction of justice continue. It gives a green light to others to think they're an imperial president that can ignore our democratic norms and values and institutions. And so that is some of, I think, you know, what leaders in the House are grappling with. In fact, I believe Nancy Pelosi had, you know, a phone call with leaders in the House to be talking through these issues.
That was Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause. For more analysis and commentary on the debate over pursuing impeachment against President Trump, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In keeping with his longstanding dismissal of climate change as a hoax, President Trump signed a pair of executive orders on April 10th that would increase the speed at which the federal government would approve construction of fossil fuel projects through limiting environmental reviews. One of the orders appears to target the Keystone XL pipeline, declaring that the decision to authorize infrastructure crossing international borders shall be made solely by the president rather than the State Department. While these executive orders are part of a broader effort to use Mr. Trump's executive authority to push through oil, gas, and coal development, if upheld, they could effectively shield the president's actions from review by the courts. One of Mr. Trump's executive orders would limit the ability of states to review and reject pipelines and other projects under a section of the Clean Water Act. States have used that law in recent years to slow or block several pipeline projects across the country. Your reporter spoke with Colin Reese, senior campaigner with Oil Change International, who talks about his group's response to Mr. Trump's executive orders and how lawsuits and public opposition could effectively stop or slow down implementation that would increase the fossil fuel industry's output of climate change-inducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Recently, Trump put out these two executive orders at the behest of his kind of big oil sponsors. We specifically know we've seen records of their calendar meetings with different agencies. We know that he has literally appointed an oil lobbyist now head of the Department of Interior, a coal lobbyist head of the EPA. There is sort of rampant infiltration of the government by literally the oil and gas and coal industries right now. So it's not a particular surprise. But the other interesting point that I like to make when I talk about these executive orders is that they're also a sign that what we're doing is exactly right. As far as those of us who are kind of fighting pipelines on the ground in the states, fighting tooth and nail to keep the Keystone XL pipeline from being built, to keep the Dakota Access Pipeline from being built, to stop these gas pipelines that are crisscrossing New York. The reason that these two executive orders were passed, one deals with cross-border permits and oil pipelines specifically, and the other one deals with water permits at the state level that are, among other things, that are used to permit gas pipeline approvals. And the reason that the industry was so frustrated and kind of begged the Trump administration to put forward these executive orders is because we've managed to stop a bunch of pipelines in the last few years. New York State has stopped the Constitution pipeline. It has a couple others that are still pending. It's kind of all these important fights that we've won and continued to build power with these fights against pipelines. And that success was actually what drove this action. So it's certainly, it's not a good thing, and I don't want to say that, but I think it is a sign that the strategy is working and that we kind of need to double down and make sure that our governors now stand up, challenge this, that our state attorney generals fight back. We're, of course, going to be in the courts and in the streets pushing back as much as we can.
Colin, as you mentioned earlier, a whole coalition of environmental groups will no doubt challenge these executive orders in court through lawsuits. What are the prospects that the courts, now with many more extremely conservative Trump federal judge appointees, will give these lawsuits a fair hearing and provide some balance here to where the Trump administration wants to go in terms of letting the fossil fuel industry loose?
It's a great question, Scott, and a really valid worry. I am not a lawyer myself, so I can't speak to all of this, but I think I'll just say that there, I think, are a few steps before we even get to that point. I think this is sort of a feature rather than a bug of the Trump administration that we've seen over the last few years, is sort of talking a big game, having a good PR setup, having a big launch event for your executive orders with a bunch of labor union folks in the background and oil industry folks and pipeline people, and then not really following through on the things that you say you're doing. So I think the first step is seeing if the agencies even implement these executive orders. It's taken them months in the past. There are some that have never even kind of gotten to the implementation stage. So one of the questions is, are they going to implement it? Do they think it's legally defensible? Are they willing to kind of even put it out there and let it be challenged by us, or do they think it's just too ridiculous on the face? So if we do get through all those pieces and they kind of implement all the pieces that he signed and said he intended to push through recently, then it does get tied up in legal challenges and goes to the court. And as you mentioned, the courts are not always our friends. Certainly, the legal system should not be the only recourse, as biased and prone as most human institutions are. And so I think it's extremely important that we continue to fight in the streets, to fight at the state level, to be pushing back directly against the industry, to continue this campaign in many, many different ways in addition to these legal challenges. As we've seen, Republicans are not really our friends. A lot of Democrats are not our friends. A lot of the political system is not our friends, but we are increasingly seeing people come around. And it's because of the impact of people campaigning on the ground, pushing on local projects. If you're in any of those states that I mentioned, if you're in New York, if you're in surrounding states, if you're in Pennsylvania, if you're in New Jersey, if you're in Oregon, if you're in Minnesota, there are very active fights in Virginia, North Carolina, West Virginia. All of these places and many more have very active fights right now over these permits, pushing Democratic governors to deny them. Get involved on a local level, figure out how you can support local campaigns. We have quite a bit of this on our website. And then make sure it gets out there, make sure it's being heard, and make sure that it's very clear sort of what the choices are. The choices are the future wished for by the fossil fuel industry, pushed for by President Trump, sort of laid out on the silver platter exactly as they told him to. Or the future is one in which we actually come together as communities, create our own energy future together, democratize and own that and move forward in a way that creates commonwealth for all. So I think we are really at a turning point here, but I have a lot of faith that if we organize together as communities and stand together for our values, that we can really make a difference.
That was Colin Reese, senior campaigner with Oil Change International. Learn more about growing opposition to Trump administration efforts to further deregulate the fossil fuel industry by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, has the power to approve or deny permits to build interstate gas pipelines and related infrastructure, such as compressor stations and gas export terminals. But in the past 30 years, the agency has turned down just 2 out of 400 applications. For almost its whole existence, FERC has acted as a rubber stamp for the fossil fuel industry, and most of its commissioners come from oil and gas companies, which they return to when their terms expire. One Democratic appointee, Richard Glick, has often opposed new projects due to climate concerns, while the other Democrat, Cheryl LaFleur, has most often, but not always, supported them. Beyond Extreme Energy is a coalition of groups and individuals, mostly along the eastern seaboard, working to retire fossil fuels. Over the past 5 years, the group known as BXE has carried out many nonviolent direct actions at FERC. On April 18th, two BXE activists scaled a 25-foot wall at FERC headquarters, sat down behind the awning over the building's front entrance, and dropped a banner reading, "Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, no. Federal Renewable Energy Commission, yes." Despite the response of large numbers of police and a fire department hook and ladder truck, the two men, Ted Glick and Drew Hudson, remained in place for 5 hours. The pair finally came down from their perch on their own, avoiding arrest. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who's a BXE member, spoke with Drew Hudson about his direct action banner drop and what's next in the group's campaign targeting FERC.
Yeah, they actually have a lot of oversight over your utility company. Wherever you live in the country, you know, you pay your monthly utility bill to some company to supply you electricity. And one of the things that FERC already has powers over is regulating the interconnection of those markets and making sure that they function reliably, that you can get electricity every time you turn the switch on. And they also have a hand in controlling some pricing. They don't literally set the price for your power bill. But they're supposed to be looking at how utility markets are run and how they're connected to each other and making sure that consumers get a fair shake. And it would be pretty simple. We've said all along, if FERC would just stop saying yes to every fossil fuel project that comes before it, that would bring up a very logical question, is, well, where are we going to get our power from instead? And FERC has had a number of conferences on grid reliability and renewable energy and the potential for storage to meet more of our electricity needs from storing renewable energy in batteries or in underground systems and all kinds of things. So they have a lot of expertise and a lot of knowledge they could deploy. And so that's why this Federal Renewable Energy Commission idea kind of came up to us when we started talking to folks in Congress about the Green New Deal. We've been calling for years for Congress to hold oversight hearings on FERC. That's something Congress is supposed to do, and like a lot of oversight things in the Trump administration, they haven't done a very good job of it for the first 2 years. But now that Democrats are in control of the Congress, we think there might be an opportunity for some new thinking, and some folks there may be interested in looking at this agency, FERC, and what it's been doing, and thinking about changing its mandate, because they do already have some pretty expansive powers to investigate and hold hearings and ask utilities to change their pricing structure and to change their energy mix. And that would fit perfectly with a vision for a Green New Deal. They could get out here and stop approving gas pipelines and start ordering utilities to find more renewable energy, to invest in those sectors, to employ more people in that, and to really jumpstart some innovation in things like big battery storage so that we can save up all the power from solar panels during the day and deploy it all at night when the sun goes down.
So it seems like this transformation from FERC to FREC to an agency that prioritizes renewable energy isn't such a crazy idea then.
It's only crazy if you believe, as FERC seems to at the moment, that the only thing we can do is keep saying yes to the gas industry every time they want to propose a new line or piece of fossil fuel infrastructure.
As part of Beyond Extreme Energy, I was on the ground outside FERC headquarters, and then some of us went into the overflow room to watch the meeting on TV. And, you know, I have to say that I was extremely distressed to hear the commissioners approve not one, but two new liquefied natural gas export terminals on the Gulf Coast.
It was a very dispiriting moment. And really, it does sort of illustrate what this fight about climate justice is all about, because not only did they approve, you know, two new major fossil fuel export projects, this is the whole purpose of these things, is going to be to dig up fossil fuels in America, and that will cause tremendous damage to groundwater and earthquakes and all of the impacts that come from fracking, which is how we get the gas out of the ground. and then we're going to ship it overseas where it's going to create, you know, misery and destruction in somebody else's country, you know, both from the climate change emissions and from the air pollution when this stuff is burned. And then not only all of that, but the two export terminals were both located in the Gulf of Mexico, which is America's sort of oldest environmental sacrifice zone and the place where we continue to just shove environmental injustice after environmental injustice on top of some of the poorest and also blackest and brownest bodies in America. And the tradition of poisoning those communities so that mid-Atlantic northeastern gas companies can make a buck continues absolutely unabated and unregarded by FERC, which is just really frustrating and angering and dispiriting at the same time. I think the reason why we take some hope is Commissioners Glick and LaFleur, as you say, have been dissenting more. LaFleur in particular is making her fight kind of about like a process argument. What she seems to want is that there would be an accounting of climate change emissions in the way FERC reviews these projects. So long as the accounting is done, she doesn't mind that it's going to destroy the climate in our common home. She just wants the math to be right, which is not really a totally sensible position to us, but that's what she's saying. But would be a big change in FERC if we can just get the commissioners to sort of acknowledge that there's a different way of doing business. And that does seem that we're making progress on that front. And ultimately, it will be up to Congress to change their mandate. You know, if we're going to rewrite parts of the Utility Act and the Natural Gas Act, that's going to take new laws and new regulations. And again, that's why we tie it back to the Green New Deal. We're very hopeful and optimistic by all this new energy created by the Sunrise Movement and by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about a Green New Deal, putting this big, bold vision forward. It's not perfect yet, and it needs a lot of development and detail added in. And we hope that this reform of FERC into FREC can be one part of that conversation and get moving in the next few years, because we only have about 12 years to act.
That was Drew Hudson, a member of the group Beyond Extreme Energy. Learn more about BXE and their clean energy fossil-free campaigns by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KMUD in Garberville, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.